This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to Back Porch Bluegrass. I'm your host, Paul Trenwith, and I hope you're going to enjoy today's program. It's a little bit special. I have a visitor in the studio with me, Keith McMillan, who is a noted luthier and musician from around Hamilton. Hello, Keith.
Hello, Paul.
We're going to be talking to you in great detail later on and maybe even hearing a little bit of mandolin playing live in the studio. So keep hanging in there, folks, and I think you're going to enjoy today's show. May is New Zealand Music Month, as you probably know, and so I try and feature New Zealand music and play music played by New Zealand musicians, and that opening track, of course, was myself playing banjo. It's a tune called Wild Goose Chase. Colleen Trenwith on fiddle, Graham Lovejoy was on mandolin, Colin Watson was on guitar, and Ann Kirkpatrick was on bass. It was recorded in Sydney, Australia in 1974, and that was one of the strange tunes that came out of my head, as they sometimes do. No accounting for it, really. I'm going to play a tune from a New Zealand band called Wires and Wood, based in Auckland, New Zealand. This recording was made about two 2010, and Wires and Wood features Brian Christensen on banjo, Michael Young on mandolin, Dave Warren on guitar, and they have a choice of bass players, and Gary Trotman is playing bass on this particular one, and he wrote the song as well, and the song is called Bluegrass Heaven, and it sounds like this.
Head on out to where the grass is blue. We'll head on out to where the grass is blue.
Wires and Wood and singing about Bluegrass Heaven, and I forgot to mention that was Reed Hudson playing dobro on that, noted New Zealand musicians who he was around in the early days of Bluegrass Expedition. He played dobro for them in the 1970s and has since been featured on lots of New Zealand albums, playing a bit of dobro, a bit of mandolin and various other things. A very accomplished musician. We have an all-girl bluegrass band in New Zealand called Hot Diggity, and from their album Worth the Wait, I'm going to play the song, title song really, called Worth the Wait. Hot Diggity is Deborah McKenzie on guitar and vocals, and Heather Carrigan on mandolin and vocals, Janine Abarbanel on double bass and vocals, and we know Janine from her work with the Pippi Pickers, but she plays bass in Hot Diggity as well. Chrissy Jankson on fiddle, and Sue Drake on banjo, and they, one great thing about the band is they write most of their own songs. In fact, this album's got 12 tunes on it, and only one was written by someone else. But I've selected the title track, Worth the Wait, written by Heather Carrigan, and she sings lead in it as well. Here's Hot Diggity.
Sitting here waiting for you. The clock ticks loud another hour or two. Waiting for the sound of your car in the drive. Some Somehow it seems like forever since you and I were together. Now there's only hours till you're in my arms. And when you're home, that's when I can breathe the gentle sigh of sweet relief. And baby, I just can't wait. And when you're home, that's when I can breathe the gentle sigh of sweet relief. And baby, you're always worth the wait. And baby, you're always worth the sense you in the wind. My eyes are already smiling. Oh, baby, come on in. Come on away, your heart is so tender and true. Come home and bide with comfort and love that burns for you. And when you're home, that's when I can breathe the gentle sweet relief. And baby, I just can't wait. And when you're home, that's when I can breathe the gentle sigh of sweet relief. And baby, you're always worth the wait. And baby, you're always worth the wait.
That was Hot Diggity, and that's about the best name for a band you could have, I reckon. It's a really great band, and they present the music absolutely beautifully, and they're always a lot of fun to watch. As I mentioned, in my studio today is a friend and fellow musician, Keith McMillan, and we're going to start off the interview by playing a track from the 2016 Hamilton County album, which was entitled These Old Hands, and it's a mandolin feature. Classic mandolin feature called The New Campdown Races. So in this band is Keith McMillan on mandolin, myself on banjo, Alan Rhodes on guitar, Tim Trenwith playing double bass, Pam, I'm not sure if Pam played guitar or she might have played a little bit of percussion on this one, and Jeremy Trenwith might have played a bit of guitar. That's my oldest son who was producing the album, and it was being recorded by Alan's oldest son, Dave Rhodes, in his studio, and we came up with something like this. Here's The New Campdown Races. Thank you. was the new Campdown Races recorded live in the studio. Do you think we should have done another take? Or
No, that was pretty good. That was pretty good.
I listen to things like that, and invariably when I listen to something that we've done, I think, well, maybe we could have done it differently.
Yeah, a bit faster.
Well, I know that when we do that song live on stage, I always say, not too fast.
The thing that I remember about recording that tune is that we'd recorded it half a dozen times just to give us some options, and Jeremy, who'd been producing, said every one of those was 3:57. Every one of them.
Yes, just
never,
the right.
Never heard that before.
Yeah, we got the...
Which enabled him to mix and match.
Yeah, yeah.
Bits if necessary, which wasn't necessary, of course.
Of course. Something like that, yes. Keith McMillan, as well as being a musician around Hamilton, New Zealand, which is where this program comes from, for many years, you also repair and set up musical instruments, and that's really why I've got you in here today. And some people don't realize how much you can get out of a guitar or a mandolin if it's not set up properly, you know.
That's absolutely true.
So tell me about the sort of work that you do.
Well, it ranges from, you know, smashed up $10,000 guitars to school violins worth about minus $50 that have to be, you know, somehow kept playable for a budget of not much at all.
Yes.
And everything in between. So, you know, a large chunk of the work is setting up instruments to work properly.
I am amazed at how important the string height at the nut is. And in the little bit of instrument making that I've done, I reckon that's just about the hardest job.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing about it is getting all of the aspects of adjusting everything in the right order so that you're not fooling around trying to correct one thing with another thing.
Yes.
As you'll have figured out in building instruments. Yeah, the thing about nuts is you've got to have a bunch of exactly the right files.
Yes, and just make it work until you've got the string exactly the right height, so it feels comfortable when you put your fingers down.
For the folks out there, the nut is the bit with grooves in it, usually made out of white bone or plastic up near the tuners, and the height of those grooves is critical, because if it's a little bit too high, which manufacturers like to err on the side of a little bit too high,
yes,
it not only makes it really hard to play on the first few notes, but it pulls all of the first few notes sharp.
Right.
And
yes,
getting that right is exactly the first thing to do. Well, actually the second, after adjusting the shape of the neck with the adjustable truss rod.
How much did you, when someone brings in a guitar that's probably about $500 worth, so it's better than an entry level guitar, but still a little bit of the bottom of the heap. How much will you do on that instrument to make it better before you can convince them to buy a better guitar?
I tell them it's always worth making the thing play properly.
Yes.
If they decide to get a better guitar and sell that one, you know, the first person who picks it up is going to buy it because it feels good.
Yes.
And most times, you know, the truth is a $500 guitar is good enough for anybody forever.
Well, it is. I'm in my music studio where I teach. I've got a small-bodied Cort, which is... It's unamplified, just a simple acoustic, and it feels very comfortable. Of course, it's been set up by Keith McMillan, but
So the first thing I do is pick it up and feel it and tell them if I think it could be improved, and I'll happily tell them if I don't think it can be improved and send them away again.
Yes.
And then I'll measure what we've got, because that's what they're used to, and it gives me an idea of what their expectations might be.
Yes.
It's no good making the strings so low that you've got to be very, very gentle with it in the hands of someone who plays like a gorilla.
Yeah, right, which is more heavy-handed like me. Yeah.
And vice versa.
Yes. What's the difference between working on a $300 guitar and a $3,000 guitar?
Actually, nothing. No, we do exactly the same things.
So when someone comes in with a Martin that's sort of been ravaged through the years and with a slightly bent neck and feeling difficult to play, and it's, you know, obviously a nice guitar, you just do the same things to that?
I do the same things and charge the same amount because it's exactly the same. Sometimes you have to hold your breath for twice as long before you start.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm just amazed. And setting up banjos, of course, is just a miracle. I know the entry-level banjos, when they come out of the factory and arrive for sale, they're really set up so that they're very playable.
Banjos are a whole extra thing because the tension of the head of the banjo has to be right. And it's even more complicated by the fact that if you change the tension of the head, you change the action. So as you tighten up the vellum, the bridge rises.
Of course, yes.
Yes, so they're a bit more complicated. And they have a sweet spot. Once you've got everything else right, that's half of the battle with the banjo. But getting the tension of the head right,
yes,
is just critical, and they just suddenly come to life.
Yes, yeah.
And I think of it as a happy banjo.
A happy banjo. I think I've got a happy banjo. Yes.
Yeah. All of the banjos in Hamilton are happy now.
Yes. Yeah. That's good. Now, when some of the entry-level banjos arrive, they have very narrow necks, especially, you know, when you play down in first position, so to speak, in the first five frets, I can barely fit my fingers on the strings. They're so close together.
That's a pretty common thing to do. If it's an inexpensive banjo, I'll just fill the slots where the strings go through the nut with, you know, matching filler and recut the grooves so that the strings have a little bit more room between them.
Yes, they don't need to be widened all that much. Just sometimes a couple of millimetres feels great.
Even a millimetre feels like an inch. It really does.
And it's so much more playable. You can start to do pull-offs and hammer-ons and things like that, and your fingers can go down without touching the adjacent string.
What are those, Paul?
Yes. Once again, do you get many good banjos in there?
Yeah, there's some fantastic banjos in New Zealand.
Yes.
You've got a couple of them.
Yeah.
But there's a heap of really, really nice banjos, and I love working on them.
Yeah, Brian Christensen of Wires and Wood, and we've had him on the program last week. He's got a lovely old Gibson, and I know he's forever pulling it to bits.
It's like 1920 something Gibson Granada, the gold standard in banjos.
And so it must be fun working on those.
Oh, it is. Yeah, it's fantastic.
You do a lot of electric guitar stuff as well, don't you?
Yep. I do everything with strings on, except for pianos, really. Yeah. Electric guitars have the same setup issues, but they also have electrical stuff that you have to get right as well. And my work on those can be changing pickups and cleaning stuff.
Right, yeah.
Installing a whole new bunch of everything sometimes.
Yeah. I know that with my Martin guitar, which is a 1960s one, a decade or so ago, put new tuning pegs on there, and I was amazed at the difference it made. I never realised that the old ones were quite so worn and less accurate.
Happens so gradually you don't notice.
Yes.
Yeah. Funnily, I've got a Martin guitar I bought new in the early 80s, and I was complaining to the Southeast Asian rep at the time that one of the tuners felt terrible, and I wanted a new set, and I never did do anything about it, and now it feels absolutely fine.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. There's so much you could do. How do you advise people on what instrument they should be playing when they've come in and they're you think they're ready for a step up?
In a way, you kind of got to suss out their budget and try and tell them to get the best they can afford.
Yes.
And I tell people that they're not really buying a thing just to play. They're buying an instrument to make them happy. And it's important that every time they go and open the case, they think,
yes.
Oh, I'm so glad I bought that. That makes me feel happy.
Yeah.
And you know, people have a different threshold. Some people expect to be made happy for $50 and other people realise that might cost more.
Yeah. Well, I know my son Sam, I think he bought just a regular Sigma. Was that from you?
Yes.
I think it was, yes. And that's a fairly inexpensive guitar.
Yeah, 500 and something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He loves that guitar and he flogs it, you know, to death. He gives a guitar a hard time.
He had a much more valuable Brazilian made guitar that I believe I remember you bought for him at an auction.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Yeah. And it was always hard work. And,
yes.
And he tried one of these Sigmas, which is a smaller body guitar with a really good pickup system and $550. And he just uses it at every gig.
He does, he does.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting, there's a guitar out there for you,
if you
search enough. And likewise, mandolins and banjos, they vary immensely. I know with the array of banjos you've got in your shop, I sometimes sit down and play them and I think, I like this, I don't like that, yes, I like that. But later on I might think, that's better than I thought it was.
Yes. Yes, you can't trust your impression on any given day, really. You've got to take a few impressions and average them out.
Yeah,
that's true.
Repairing the woodwork on guitars. You know, I know that I've seen smashed instruments every now and then, and they're not quite the same as Bill Monroe's mandolin, which was 297 pieces, I think, and they spent months just sorting out which piece came from which mandolin and where it was to go. An absolute jigsaw. But I've seen instruments in there that, you know, everything from broken necks and where the headstock's fallen off and to ones that have been look like they've been smashed over someone's head.
I've had the works all right. The most badly smashed was a violin that got broken into pieces small enough to post into a letterbox. And I saw that violin again many years later and I couldn't even see where I'd repaired it. That there's this thing that happens where somehow the repair lines fade into the wood.
And scar heals.
Yeah, the scar heals.
Yeah.
I had a classical guitar that got sat on accidentally and the soundboard was smashed into 20 pieces and I put that back together.
Yes, wow.
And it sounded better than it did before.
Well, I have heard that said about repaired instruments, that they often sound better, but it's hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine, but sometimes, you know, sometimes it happens.
Yeah. Okay, Keith, well, you've got a Macmillan mandolin there.
Which is a coincidence, isn't it?
We'll talk about that after we've played a tune. What tune should we play?
I was thinking Panhandle Rag.
That's good. Yeah, not too fast.
Not too fast. And we should talk about the guitar you're playing.
This is 1966 Martin D21.
Brazilian rosewood, one of the finest guitars in the land.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Pity it hasn't got a good player. But
okay, here we go. Panhandle Rag. Thank you.
but it was fun.
A couple of mistakes in there.
Oh, that's, you got to put those in because there might be some mandolin players listening, and they would really like to hear some mistakes.
We've got to be encouraging everything we do. So, the mandolin I'm playing has got Macmillan written on the end, and I made it. Made it back in the early 80s, actually. Wow. I started building this and then thought, oh, I'm still going to need a good mandolin.
Yes.
Because this is not going to come out well, I was pretty sure.
Yes.
So I ordered a Gilchrist mandolin from Steve Gilchrist in Australia at the same time, and then as luck would have it, the Gilchrist arrived and the Macmillan was finished within a week of each other.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And for the first couple of years, the Macmillan was better than the Gilchrist.
Well, I'll describe it. It's F5 looking mandolin and mid browny colour. There's probably a name for that colour rather than mid brown.
Tobacco burst or something like that.
Yeah. And it's all nice and sort of shiny.
The varnish on it is a kauri gum. It's a blend of nitrocellulose lacquer and kauri gum in 50-50 proportions.
What's a kauri gum do to it?
I don't know. I just thought it would look nice, and it does.
That's a very New Zealand thing, because in the 1800s, there were kauri gum diggers all over Northland.
Yes.
So kauri gum was a expensive commodity, I think, wasn't it?
And it was used for making varnish, and it was also used for making linoleum.
Oh, was it really?
Sent to Scotland and made into lino.
Oh, is that right?
I don't know how, but yeah. So the tailpiece on it is solid silver, and it was made by a jeweller friend of mine called Brian Dodds.
Wow.
And it's a nice mandolin.
Yes, it is a nice mandolin. It plays well, and it sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's... you made any more mandolins?
Nope. No, I got it right the first time. the plan is, if I get less busy with work, I might make some mandolins, but at the moment I don't have the time, and somehow I don't have the urge.
They're particularly difficult to make, aren't they, with the carved tops and the thicknesses of the tops and thicknesses of the back and all that sort of stuff?
Yep, they're a lot of work. They used to reckon 200 to 250 hours to make a mandolin, and a guitar would be more like, I don't know, 25 perhaps?
Yeah. So, oh, that was good. Well, that was live in the studio, and a lovely version of Panhandle Rag. That's a neat tune.
Yeah.
I've got two delightful women that come to me for ukulele lessons, and we've learned Panhandle Rag on ukuleles, with one picking lead and the other one doing rhythm and then swapping over, and they love the tune, and it's a lot of fun to play.
Well, in fact, I learned it off you.
Yeah. So many versions. It's one of the rare mandolin tunes that you can find versions and play versions in almost any key. I mean, we did it in A, it's been done in F, it's done in C, it's done in G. I think the first time I heard it was on a gospel record from California.
Wow.
And they put the track on the end of that album. Okay, so what work have you got in your shop at present?
A couple of expensive guitars with some warranty problems. Binding, which is a white, normally plastic or tortoise shell or something that goes around the edges of the body is pulled out in the waists in two or three places, and I've got to stretch that back into place and glue it, and then, you know, retouch the finish so that it looks like nobody's been there. And then also on my workbench I have a very valuable Gibson Les Paul guitar with a broken neck, and that's not uncommon.
How do they break? What are
they fall over and then they break. The neck wood is mahogany, and it's probably not as strong as it would be made out of maple, but Gibson say, well, that's the tradition, and don't drop your guitar.
Which is fair enough.
And so this particular break is a really ugly one. It's broken like directly across the grain, not along it. And so what I've done is a temporary glue job, and then I've made a long, thin wedge-shaped cut,
yes,
through the middle of all of the abruptly broken stuff, in a sort of a horizontal way, like, yes, parallel with the front of the peg head. And then I've shaped a piece of mahogany and glued that into there, and now I'm at the moment just refinishing.
Yeah.
So that'll be just as strong as it was when it was new, or probably, yes, stronger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an interesting job. Now, I know that something that has intrigued me in the past about things you do is you do neck resets. Now, I know a few people who could do with those, but I know guitars, and it strikes me as that's a terribly difficult thing to do.
Yeah, with your modern steel string guitar, the neck's not made to be easily removed. Taylor guitars are actually bolted on.
Oh, yeah.
And they're relatively easy to change the neck angle. Martins and everything else in the world are glued in with a proper dovetail join, and it's actually a bit of a job to take the neck out. But essentially, the glue goes soft when it gets hot, and so you can soften the glue any way you like. And what I do is make a tiny little hole through where the 13th fret would be.
Yes.
Take the fret out and drill down where the fret was, and that's actually very easy to disguise later, and put a 1/8 inch or 3.2 millimeter copper rod attached to a soldering iron and give it heaps, and that makes the whole dovetail joint hot, and the glue, which is essentially just PVA or aliphatic glue,
yeah,
Get soft enough that you can lift the neck out. The top of the fingerboard, the upper part of the fingerboard, is glued onto the top, so
right,
at some point you've got to lift that off, but that, yes, that's easy. And then presto, out comes the neck, and then you let everything get cold again, and then set about re-angling it back to...
So you just reshave it so it has less angle or more angle? Or
more angle. Generally what happens is over time the neck appears to lift, in the sense that if the guitar was on its back on a table,
yeah,
the neck would have lifted. But it's not actually quite that simple. I think the top of the guitar compresses.
Right.
And the neck moves, maybe.
Yeah.
So what we do is restore... that angle, so that you can still have a saddle, which is the white bone bit that sticks out of the bridge. You know, you'd want 2 or 3 millimeters above the bridge level, and a nice low action.
Right. Yes.
At the end of it, depending on people's requirements.
Most people require a lower action these days. I mean, in the 1950s, particularly in bluegrass, people belted their guitars and needed a high action with heavy strings, but you can't even buy heavy strings these days, can you?
Yeah, you can. I once had a set.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bob Jones wanted them.
Oh,
yeah,
right, yes.
Yeah, a friend of ours called Bob Jones, who was a fantastic guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, these days we use pickups if we need to make more noise, don't
yes,
we?
Yes, yeah, it's
and
quite different.
PA systems are better, and actually, I've been to a couple of concerts in the last couple of weeks where actually the band was really quiet.
Yeah.
And yet it had the level of intensity of a loud band somehow.
Right.
It's a trick.
Yes,
That sounds
really interesting doing that. I've got this 1966 Martin over here, which shows signs of having been used.
Yes.
What would you recommend I do with that?
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all.
Yeah, nothing at all. It might need a neck reset one day. The strings are kind of high. But it's already had a new fingerboard.
Yes.
I remember 15 years ago, maybe,
the
fingerboard was worn out and the frets were worn out. And actually, at Paul's suggestion, we put a new fingerboard on but left it a millimetre or two wider.
That's right, yes.
Than the standard rather than sort of rounding off the neck where the fingerboard joins it. We left it to keep getting a little wider.
We cribbed about a millimetre and a half, didn't we?
Yeah. And you'd never know to look at it, but it just made it a little bit easier to fit your fingers in.
Yeah, my old tired fingers just had more space to work. Yeah. It's been a great guitar and always sounded good. It always sounds good in the studio. I know when Jeremy's played guitar with us, he's used that guitar rather than his Taylor, although in live gigs he tends to use the Taylor these days.
Yeah.
So let's do another tune, eh? St. Anne's Reel is always a tune that I love to hear you play your mandolin. Sounds great. And I'll play some guitar and we'll see what it sounds like, eh?
Okay.
Where do I put my pick? Here it is.
Nothing like live radio.
No. My guitar style these days is with a thumb pick and my fingers doing a sort of Carter Family scratch, and I can feel as though I can provide the best rhythm doing that because my elderly hands aren't responding so well to using flat picks these days.
my pick, which is interesting to any guitarist or mandolin player, is a tortoise shell pick.
Yeah.
On one of my other mandolins, I've got a blue chip pick I normally use, but for this mandolin, it just works best.
Yeah.
With an actual tortoise shell pick, and it's a bit thick, but it's sort of nothing like David Grisman's thick.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's do key of D.
Yep. Slippers.
Oh, I love that tune. That is such a neat tune. Golden Slippers in the key of D following St. Anne's Reel. Okay, so you got to go back to work soon.
I do.
And what will you go back and do?
I'll do a little
answer
bit
all the messages.
Yeah. I've got a couple of people picking up instruments. I've got to do some more work on the Gibson.
Yes.
I mentioned before, and I've got to get on with the other one that's got the pulled out binding because that's now becoming slightly overdue.
Yes.
You know, people don't sort of realise that when you're doing a job that involves refinishing or even retouching the finish, you've just got to do it gradually and spread out, because otherwise, you know, you don't get a nice looking result at the end.
I can say this quite authoritatively, but I've seen some of the repair work and I'm just amazed at the fact that you can repair a piece on the front of a guitar and not be able to see where you've repaired it because you've managed to get the finish the same. And I'm still mystified as to how you do that. But
The trick is just not to ever hurry it. You've just got to do a little bit and then put it aside.
Yeah.
And come back the next day and then do a little bit more.
Yeah. Oh, well, I hope that goes good. It's been great talking to you, Keith.
Yeah, thank you, Paul.
Oh, it's I think if you've got an instrument at home and it needs a revival, take it along to Keith and he'll do a great job on repairing it, and you'll have an instrument in your hands that you absolutely love playing, and that is such a good feeling.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So here's a tune that Keith wrote and that the Hamilton County Bluegrass Band recorded in 2016 called the Hickawai Hornpipe. Hickawai Hornpipe, played by Keith McMillan and the Hamilton County Bluegrass Band. You're listening to Back Porch Bluegrass. I'm your host, Paul Trenwith. We're sponsored by Shearer's Music Works, which is a music store in Hamilton, New Zealand, and they do a good job of providing all the accessories and the instruments that you could possibly want to the music playing population around Hamilton, New Zealand, which is where this program comes from. And Keith will fix it up for you if you need it, if you break it. Yeah. Oh, they got a pretty good relationship going there. You have to have when you're working in a place like this. What else do I need to say? Big hello to all the people listening on the Access Radio stations throughout New Zealand and throughout Canada and the USA. Thank you very much for tuning in at whatever time you're particular station takes Back Porch Bluegrass. I'm delighted that you're tuning in to my take on bluegrass music from way down here in New Zealand. All the people who tune in on podcasts, thank you very much for doing that. There's quite a few of you. I get the sort of monthly results. We can measure how many people tune into podcasts, but we can't measure how many people listen to the live radio, but that's That's fine. It's good. I enjoy doing the show. It's all from my own shelves and my own resources and my own experience of bluegrass music after playing it since the 1960s and having a lot of fun in doing so. I'm going to play you one of the tunes which was probably one of the first original bluegrass songs to be recorded in New Zealand. And there's one written by Alan Rhodes, guitar player and lead singer for Hamilton County Bluegrass Band. This was on the Yesterday's Gone album of ours, recorded in 1969. And one of the opening tracks, Alan sang the lead, David called a harmony, and I think I did the baritone harmony. And it's a New Zealand tune in New Zealand Music Month. That's a good thing. Here's Give Me a Chance to Be With You.
Chance to be with you once more when the spring comes by again, and I know that our love will be much stronger as years go by. I love you just the same.
Well, what did you think of that? That was pretty good.
Yeah, I had no idea Alan wrote that.
Yeah, well, that was one of the first bluegrass songs to do. Well, we're just about at the end of Back Porch Bluegrass. Thanks very much for coming in, Keith. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
We'll take it out with a fiddle tune from that same album. And this is a fiddle medley. Colleen was pretty good at putting together medleys of tunes. And it's a medley of three tunes, which I have written in the cover of the CD. Fisher's Hornpipe, Mississippi Sawyer, and Chicken Reel. And this features the wonderful fiddle playing of Colleen Bain, as she was then, soon to become Colleen Trendworth. And she spent the last decade of her life really at East Tennessee State University teaching fiddle to people. So I wonder if she taught them this tune. This is what she was doing in 1969 anyway. Let's see if we can find it.
Thanks for listening to this Free FM podcast. If you want to hear more content like this, you can support Free FM via Patreon. Head to patreon.com/freefm89 to find out more.